Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is the LA Steel Show. I'm Leo. Sorry we started a little late tonight. My fault. I couldn't get into my computer. For some reason, it's very, very slow. Still slow. And tonight we're going to continue where we left off last week, which was the we were reading a lecture by Manly Hall, and it was called the Wonders of Ocean. And that particular lecture, I mean, exactly sure how to explain it, other than it's the concept that the world or human consciousness is, or rather the ocean is the icon or archetypical representation of the human consciousness. And I'm going to have to refer you to last Thursday night's lecture reading, because we're going to start about the middle of this one where we left off last week, and hopefully we'll be able to get through it to this evening. I believe that we began, if I can recall it, on page 6 or 7 of the of this lecture. Our chat room is now open. Okay, join us. I'm going to begin on page 6. So there are strange forms, mysterious plaguing things that rise and develop and grow in the subconscious life of man. And we can ask how man happened to invent such an idea of the subconscious. There is no question in the world that it all began on the outside, that man, experiencing various things that he could not understand, gradually developed fantastic explanations because no other explanation was available. Knowledge, instead of solving the problem and taking away the fantasy, merely enlarged it, because everything man learned only taught him how much more he did not know. And learning, instead of solving everything, has ended in the greatest question mark of all. Therefore, today, when perhaps it is not easy for us to believe in all the monstrous forms depicted around St. Anthony, we are able to, and it's the temptation of St. Anthony, we are able to suspect, to fear, that space itself may be inhabited by armies that want to conquer the earth. We wonder whether we will be invaded by beings of some other cosmos. Always, those beings out there seem dangerous to us simply because we do not know them. We may find these planets uninhabited, but long before they are societies, excuse me, long before they are so explored, many will have frightened themselves into decline over the possibilities. So space, which is another kind of ocean, is filled with potential menace. We are trying to understand what spaceships might be and whether these long sausage links floating across the sky are reality and some scientific truth, or were born in the imagination of, shall we say, excited people. All these problems remain the mysteries They always were, because man is a mysterious creature existing in the midst of a mystery. He is strangely frightened and disturbed, but he does not really know how to put his universe in order. If we go still further into the inner life of man, we may find that it has another likeness to the ocean. If we could have some form of clairvoyant sight by which we could pierce the surface of the water and see down into this great region below, we would discover that it is the graveyard of ancient ships, carrying their living cargo to an eternal rest into the darkness of ocean's depth. The opinion is now that most of the wreckage never reaches the bottom, but floats in a stratum somewhere. It goes so deep and no deeper unless the sea is shallow enough for it to reach the bottom, and floats forever in some middle distance. This again carries a psychological parallel. In the subconscious of man, there is a strange wreckage that never comes to the top and never seems to quite reach the bottom of things. Perhaps this represents the way in which our subconscious is gradually filled up, and also the source of the strange ghostly pressures that come from it. It is loaded with the wreckage of our own attitudes, emotions, thoughts, and actions. Here, then, in the subconscious of man is the graveyard of its own experiences, escapades, purposes, everything that he has attempted and found beyond his strength, and also the wreckage of things he has attained and found they were not worth attaining. So there is a strange rubbish in this subconscious, and it is as though into it, as into the ocean, flows all the refuse of the world. Now, ocean is also the great purifier. Everywhere on the surface of the earth, the refuse of human life and of nature flows finally into the mystery of ocean. But in the great salt body of the sea, a wonderful process of purification is forever taking place. And even in this process of purification, the sea does not sterilize itself. It is full of life at all times. This again takes us back to consciousness itself, which must receive all the refuse of our thinking. Consciousness must accept all our disappointments, disillusionments, and despair. It must receive the cry of pain in the night, the struggle to live in those last mysterious transitional processes by which life ends, or those mysteries of birth by which life has its beginnings. Consciousness must absorb, transmute, and purify all the manifestations of itself. The Easterner believes that consciousness can do this because it is deeper and greater than all the manifestations that arise from it. As it gives birth to love and hate, as it creates hope and fear, so in the end of things, consciousness takes them all into itself and redeems them. Thus, consciousness becomes like the ocean, the great purifier of life. And the Easterner would say that when we find the reality and the purposes of the law, then consciousness has redeemed the uncertainties that were cast upon its surface. We remember the wisdom of the great Taoist philosopher Lao Tse, who likened the whole cycle of existence to the cycle of water. For water rising from the sea is drawn into the air to form clouds, and these clouds drift over the mountains, and there the rain falls. The rain falling into the streams and rivulets comes down the mountains to form the rivers. Cities and towns receive their water from the great stream, and the rivers make fertile the earth where the farmers plant his rice. But the river always goes back into the sea. Then, after a course of proper time, the light and heat draw the water into the sky, clouds form, and the great cycle is repeated. This is life. One condition and eternal motion, one substance picked up and carried away from itself, only to return inevitably to itself again. Life is a process of the flowing of a river through a world of experience, where the farms and cities and meadows exist. Life is forever a cycle from the sea to the farms, rather from the sea, or what we may call from the unseen to the unseen, passing for a little time through the sphere of visibility. So again, we have the symbolism of ocean. We are reminded again of the Buddhist concept of nirvana as the symbol of the infinite. Arnold, in his beautiful poem, gives us a formula for nirvana when he says, Om Mani Padme Hum. The daybreak comes and the dewdrop slips back into the shining sea. This is nirvana, the return of the divided to the total, the return of the little drop of water to the sea, the return of all this great cycle that Lao Tzu described, for the little drop of water is a drop of rain that has been picked out of the sea by the sun. So in the Buddhist philosophy, the sea does not represent the awful depths in which men die, but the wonderful ocean in which finally we achieve perfect immortality. To these people, there is only one ultimate that is worthy of the state of man, and that is the unity with life itself. Western man expresses this thought when he says that all growth, all suffering, all living lead back to God. For God, as Western man's symbol of the infinite, is that totality, that completeness, that all-sufficientness toward which we all strangely and wonderfully long, even though we do not understand what it is. Somewhere beyond condition is what is that which transcends condition. Beyond pain is peace. Beyond all the uncertainties of things are the tranquilities of principles. Beyond life as we know it is the serenity of the infinite. So in Buddhism, the ocean represents this total serenity, consciousness no longer conditioned by any vanity or delusion by which we disturb the surface of our living. To achieve this inner calm, man must master the mystery of ocean, which for him is the mystery of commotion, the process of constant change, the motion of tireless sea, forever struggling, constantly moving as though some great surging power would not let it rest. In Christian mysticism, the Master Jesus, walking upon the stormy water, said, Be still, and the sea was quieted. And in the Eastern approach to life, also, the individual who controls his stormy emotions and achieves this feeling of great quietude suddenly senses that the storm of life is not necessary. It is not an actual reality. It is something that he permits and not something that is forced upon him by powers or conditions beyond his control. The Easterner, therefore, seeks to end forever this great upsurging of the secret courses and currents of motion in himself. He seeks to free himself from the storms and the air that may disturb the quiet surface of the deep. Man realizes that one of the great dangers of the sea is communicated to it from something else, the air. The sea itself has its currents and tides, but they are deep and for the most part strangely calm. But the sea swept by the winds becomes a terrible thing, breaking upon the shore, destroying the world men have tried to build and carrying away homes, inundating great areas of the earth. This is the tragedy of it all, the tragedy of the ocean and the hurricane. But the wise men said, man is different from the ocean in one particular. He can control the hurricanes because the only hurricanes that can really disturb his ocean are always in himself. Perhaps they are simulated or stimulated or justified by outer circumstances, but the greater storms are the ones that men permit to occur, not the storms that must happen. So the individual tries to detach himself from the stress and strain of outward pressures. He tries to quiet his nature. He tries to quell the storm with the divine powers in himself, saying to the waves, Be still. And he knows in himself that he has the power to calm, to cause them to obey. For that power is the great spirit of internal peace in his own soul, the peace which he knows he also possesses, and which is his strength against the storm. The quiet meditative way of life gradually liberates man from the hurricanes, tornadoes, and gales, and would otherwise whip his thoughts and emotions into frenzies. He finds that if he can live a gentle, quiet life, he is not impoverished. He is not a lonely, deserted creature because he has a certain measure of self-control. And in his quietude, he begins to discover the wonders of himself, for he comes in contact with the world beneath the surface of things. He learns that by going into himself, he becomes a citizen of another dimension of existence. He is able to live in the realm of consciousness if he knows within himself that he can, and he will not be drowned in its depth, but will find the perfect solution to his own need. To sum up this phase of our subject, then, we can say that the sea, in its depth, became the symbol of eternity, reality, and peace. But the surface of the sea symbolized impermanence, all the confusion and ignorance of the mortal storm of existence. There is another interesting symbolism that has descended to us in the mystical traditions of old times, particularly in a tradition called Illuminism, which had a considerable revival in Germany in the 18th century under Weishaupt. In Illuminism, there is the story of the diver who goes down under the sea in search of the pearl of great price. In this case, the sea becomes the symbol of embodiment, and the individual taking upon himself a form and being immersed into the mystery of generation. The Greeks declared that generation was an ocean into which souls fell and drowned. They did not truly die, but they were so obscured in their inner natures that they were no longer able to be aware of their own existence. This sea was a strange realm of psychic death, in which spiritual life ceased to have authority over the actions of living things. The sea was therefore the abode of the pearl, or the flaming jewel of the Eastern philosophical system. This pearl, or great price, represented man's final regeneration of himself. It was the human existence of the infinite wisdom of things, by which man became capable of the complete conscious dedication to truth. It was therefore the wonderful gem that was hidden in the palace of the Sea King, guarded by a terrible dragon. Everywhere and always it symbolizes the achievement of truth and full understanding of life, the perfection of the soul, gem within the individual. This is the priceless jewel of immortality, for he who has possessed the full insight of things cannot die, though his body may fatigue and depart. Immortality is not of the flesh, but of the consciousness within the body itself. In the story, the man descending into the ocean in search of the pearl symbolizes the descent of the soul into the embodiment in search of experience. Many people have believed that the ocean, in this case, is the ocean of the mystical experience itself, that guarded by the secrets and esoteric teachings of antiquity, there was a deep, mysterious inner world which men could not ordinarily enter. This world is the realm of their own reality. It is the region variously called the unconscious or consciousness. Unconscious, because we are not aware of it. And consciousness, because in some mysterious way it is the infinite life of consciousness that sustains all the diversity of man's mental and emotional function. Man seeking reality must therefore, by will and yoga, descend from the surface to the innermost parts of himself. He must penetrate into the ocean of his own being. We know that in antiquity, ocean was the symbol of generation. It was also the symbol of imagination, of fantasy. It represented the whole strange, wonderful emotionalization of life, following inevitably in the course of the moon, for the human soul is the prisoner of the moon. In this also there is an interesting thought that perhaps It is not in the ocean of mind that the secret is hidden, but in the ocean of the heart, that in some wonderful way, emotion rather than thought is the great ocean that conceals things. Man is the land and the continents. Emotion is the sea. The man has its dimensions and its boundaries, and men explore it, and they explore with it its parallel on the planet. But the ocean is known only by feeling. We can explore its surface a little, but the wealth of it comes only through our imagination. The ocean creates moods. It binds us to the strange sympathies of life. And so, in seeking within our own natures, we may discover this pearl of great price in the ocean of feeling, rather than upon the land of mind and thought. Love, friendship, kindness, renunciation, brotherhood, these are the emotions of good through which we approach the good. We will never find it by mental analysis performed by the rational power. We discover it only by the great sympathies that exist in nature, and these sympathies, locked within ourselves, are in mysterious rapport with the infinite sympathies around us. This brings to mind the deep quietude of compassion that is such an important aspect of Buddhistic thought. In Northern Buddhism, the Bodhisattva vow is a great emotional experience. It is the renunciation of the self, a letting go of self to embrace instead the infinite love of the eternal power. The individual who takes this vow chooses to love the real rather than to direct his emotions and his attitudes toward the advancement of the impermanent concerns of his own life. There are many ways in which he can further symbolize the idea of ocean. One of the earliest symbols of Christianity was the fish. Messiah was represented by a fish. Great apostle upon whom the church was built was the big fisherman, and the official signet ring of the popes of Rome from the beginning has been the fisherman's ring. The nave of the church is so named because it is the ship of salvation upon the ocean of existence. Holy water, baptism, these again tie man to the water principle. They represent the continuance of the idea also of the dividing circumstance between the world of life. The River Jordan also carries this symbolism. It is the one more river that men must cross. It is the river of life, the equivalent of the river Styx in the ancient Greek and Roman legendary. It is the mysterious river on whose other shore is the land beyond the world, across which the ship of the doctrine carries souls into the unknown region beyond. Thus, among the meanings of ocean or sea is the transition itself, the departure of life or the coming of life. And to the ancients, this mysterious interval between the worlds was a sea of energy, a transitional kind of energy, or element, which held together the visible and the invisible. It was a substance somewhat partaking of materiality and somewhat partaking of the immaterial. And to cross the interval, man had a body of this energy within himself, in which he functioned after the disintegration of his physical form. The early 20th century mystics referred to this as the etheric body. It was a body of transition to carry the being across the sea that divided this world from the other. The early Christian church had much of this type of thinking. It is significant also that the fish of Christianity was a dolphin. In the early manuscripts and sculptings, it is always so depicted. The Greeks knew about the amazing emotional reflexes of this creature. Modern man has discovered that the dolphin is perhaps psychically nearer to the human being than any other creature, having faculties and powers that transcend those of man. The Greeks referred to the dolphin as the friend of man because the dolphin mingled with humanity and was even known to have saved human lives. It was the divine fish in the sea of eternity. The dolphin undoubtedly has a consciousness that is not of this world, and this remarkable creature actually also binds together ocean and land, for it is of both the sea and the land. It is really a land creature living in the sea. This peculiar amphibious condition also related to the early Christian belief, and before that back into earlier pagan beliefs, that the Messiah would be able to live in two worlds. That is, he would contain within himself both a heavenly and an earthly nature, the heavenly one being the nature of the sea of eternity. Baptism as immersion in the sea represents another interesting aspect of the ocean, namely its cleansing power. Water is known as the purifier, and in the ancient times, whenever temples were built, miniature bodies of water were set up. And even today, in nearly all religions, water plays a symbolic part in the purification of man. It is a symbol of the principle of purity itself. There is a story of an old Christian bishop who always kept a few little fish in the baptismal font because this symbolized God and the Messiah in the ocean of holiness. And the use of the fish as food on Friday also was a link with the sea, going back to the idea that out of the waters, out of the ocean, comes salvation, the fish representing the body of the Redeemer. All around the world, we find sacred fountains, sacred wells, and streams, the deflection of natural waters in the pools to be used in piety. In several of the great religions, ablutions are required as part of the practice of the faith. In some religions, a man cannot pray until he has washed his mouth with water in order that all worldliness may be washed out of it. In every Muslim mosque, there is a tank or pool for purification, and until a man has washed his feet and his hands, he has no right to pray. Many of the old temples still have cisterns of water and dippers for the use of pilgrims. We might say that it is a little unsanitary to have millions of pilgrims using the same dipper, but as far as is known, there has not been much disease communicated by these rituals, perhaps because these ablutions are performed with absolute spiritual integrity, and the integrity of the individual protects him. In India, men come to die at the Ganges River, and the body of the dead are floated down to the sea. Yet all come to this river to purify their bodies against the sins of the flesh. It is assumed, of course, that the Ganges, the great mother of rivers, will carry the sins to the ocean, and there, whatever is unclean will be cleansed forever. And how ancient man came to imagine that the oceans took up the impurities of the earth, we do not know. We have nothing to base such an experience on, and it was long before he even discovered the meaning of such things. Yet he had his feeling before he knew that sanitation existed. It was simply an inner consciousness in himself. When the Japanese performed the Obon ceremony to wish their deceased relatives and friends a happy afterlife, on the last day of the ceremony, the souls returned to the sea in little ships that have candles and lanterns on them. The Viking dead were sent out to sea in blazing ships. Always the sea returns to itself. Those who have lived close to it have understood its mystery, have built their religious life around it. I remember bringing a very wise old Indian from the reservation in New Mexico and showing him the ocean for the first time. He stood before it with the expression on his face that was almost unbelievable. You cannot explain it. Awe, mystery, wonder, and above all, the bright light of an eternal faith. He told me later that he saw in the great ocean the very presence of the spirits. This finally was their home, the sea, the symbol of infinite life. Even though he had never seen the oceans before, it meant exactly the same to him as it meant to those who had loved and studied it and lived along its shore. This is the wonder of ocean. Today we are thinking of ocean in terms of minerals and chemicals, of how we are going to exploit it as the next undeveloped frontier of human achievement. We will probably do this. We will find ways, many things that they've never believed existed. And to the average person who is interested only in setting up a chemical plant and finding some way of taking the salt out of the ocean, the ancient symbolism will not be very important. To the old symbolists, the salt of the sea came from the tears of suffering, and we will do very well indeed if we can take the salt of tears out of the waters of life one of these days. It will be an achievement, but I am afraid we will not do it by chemical means. We must call upon the gentle mystery of alchemy, the transmutation of all these things through appreciation, understanding, and insight. The sea is the source of things, and most people believe their continents came out of the ocean. In the great sea of life, many religions originated and were carried from nation to nation, from continent to continent, across the great broad swell of ocean. And after men learned to travel on water, civilization became a world process. Ocean has been a wonderful symbol to man in many mysterious ways. But I think our particular understanding of it today is perhaps associated most closely with this idea of the ocean as consciousness, within which will be found many of the treasures of the world. In this ocean of consciousness, of which some is captured within ourselves, in the depths of our own eternal life, here hidden from sight, are all the inventions that have not yet been invented, all the wonders that are not yet known, all the answers to which we have scarcely yet framed the questions. In the depth of this ocean is our home of peace, of glory, and immortality. And somehow, through this ocean, we must find our own path to eternity. The ocean within us is a symbol of the infinite potential of ourselves, rich with the genius, the musician, the poet, and the artist. Within the most selfish of us is locked the Savior. Within the most cruel, the universal benefactor. And in the weakness is eternal strength. We must explore these resources. We must build upon them great wealth of secret things. We must gradually reveal and release into manifestation the great mystery that is within our sea of eternal life. Beneath the surface of this ever-flowing, ever-moving current is not only the old but the new, lost empires and empires yet unfashioned. As a child explores through growing up and learning something of the power of the inner self, so the adult must also continue to grow and learn, experiencing more and more of this mystery, this wonder of the sea. The old Japanese priest, Hichiren, looking out over the sea, beheld the dawn with the sun rising over the ocean, and he declared that this was the symbol of eternal truth, rising over the ocean of infinity. He was a symbol of the great enlightenment. He was the great teacher and the great teaching. It was truth and the wisdom and love and life rising out of the infinite potential. This sunshine over the Sunrise over the sea is the perfect representation of the covenant of the light of truth rising in the heart of man, and of the victory everywhere of eternal light over the darkness of doubt and insecurity. And that's the end of that essay, or lecture, by Manly P. Hall. And I found it to be actually a remarkable essay, because I guess I never really associated the ocean with the consciousness, with human consciousness, or especially my own. But there's no question there's a reason. There is an emotional attachment that we have to the water and to the ocean, especially. To stand in front of the ocean on a beach or house or balcony or deck or wherever you are. And just to look at the vast, vast expanse of that ocean is it's a remarkable feeling. One of the strangest places I've ever been that I felt the power of the ocean was at the Breakers in Newport. This is a mansion that was built by the Vanderbilts and Cornelius Vanderbilt, actually. A huge mansion. And but among his many rooms and features, it has a balcony, a stone balcony, a mosaic balcony, and very large, but it's columns and stuff, and you look, it's in the back of the it's in the back of the building, all right, it's in the back of the building, and what happens is it is if you stand there. And you look out, if you stand on that balcony, looking outwards, not only do you gain the sense of massive wealth, that, I mean, you can just imagine the wealth that the Vanderbilts had. And they, as they built this thing back at the turn of the century, of the 20th, at the beginning of the 20th century, these were the barons. These were the men of tremendous fortune, and they built this. They built these mansions in Newport, and they overlooked. They were right on the beach. They overlooked the Newport beach, the beach area, the water, and I swear to God, you stand on that balcony and you just absorb the ocean. I mean, it's just there, and you can see for miles, you know, just miles of massive miles of green ocean. I mean, it's just amazing. And if the wind's a little up there and the wind blows at you, it's just, I don't know, it just enwraps you and enthralls you in the infinite. And you feel like you just feel like a spirit, you know. You feel spiritual. You feel part of the universe there. So empowering. It's so. I mean, after you leave that, you just feel like you've been touched by God, you know, and you have the power of the universe. Just remarkable. So. And so you can understand, in some ways, why, when you stand there, why these men of tremendous fortune felt that they had everything, and they were tapped into the universe there. They had their own backyard in the ocean, wonders of ocean, and their imaginations just soared. They could have anything, do anything, be anything they wanted to be. They had all the money that they ever possibly need, and they hired these craftsmen from overseas, and they in their rooms that are in these mansions that replicate the Sun Mansion, the Versailles, you know, it's just remarkable. But the key, not that the materialism, but it was a blend that regardless of the materialism, you could stand there. You could stand there on that balcony and look out into the ocean and just see this expanse of green and just know, and meeting the sky, you know, and you just know that that was God speaking to you. You knew that that was the power of the universe there, and you could feel it, and you could absorb it, and you could, and if you tapped into it, you felt stronger. You felt that you could conquer the universe, you could conquer the world after you left that balcony, you know, after you, he just felt so inspired. And you take that back home with you, and that exhilaration feeling lasts weeks and months, actually. You can tap into that incredible feeling continually, even now, as I remember it. Radiates through my body and just like wow in my mind, and it's a vivid image. I see it now, just as we speak. I can see it in my mind's eye. I close my eyes and I can visualize that entire scene, and it was one of absolute magnificence. And you know, I hope anybody and everybody one day can go to Newport, Rhode Island, and check out the breakers. And get that feeling, but that is the wonders of ocean. And please, I'm going to ask those who aren't familiar with my show or may be joining me, please go back to last Thursday night's show where we did the first part of this lecture, and tonight we did the second part of Manly P. Hall's lecture of Wonders of Ocean that was written in actually 1966, I believe. But again, the manifestation of that infinite power as was before me, as in front of me, that you couldn't help through the wind just suck it in every pore and fiber of your being, and just looking out there and looking at that magnificent view and seeing and being a part of it, being a full, complete part of the universe there, of nature, of whatever, but as man. And that experience is a life experience. It's one that I experienced over 20 years ago at first, and I used to go back every year just to get that charge, you know, again. And I had friends of mine who used to go there, especially one from a good friend of mine used to go to Newport, and he would do the same thing I would. He would walk along the breakers and the board. They used to have a beach, I think they still do. Beach walk, they call it. And you could walk along there right in front of all the mansions, and it was just absolutely overwhelmingly stimulating. And you couldn't wait to go back home, and you couldn't wait to dive into your ambitions there and do whatever. And like I said, that vision would last, would stay in my mind for weeks and months, and never failed to go back home. And at that time, when I used to go regularly, I used to be a financial broker, mortgage broker, and a real estate broker. And I had a company and several agents and so on. But I would go there, and I would recharge the batteries. I'd come back. And I would throw myself into the business and become, you know, and just, you know, create wealth and create money. But more so just the ambition. You fired your ambition. You just fired it up, and you wanted to. And you just felt connected to the universe. and it gave you this tremendous power that you just felt, you know, you radiated this power, you felt it. And almost anything you touched turned to gold, if that's what you wanted to happen. And it was a wonderful time, a wonderful experience. But this is exactly what the power of ocean, the wonders of ocean, translate to the human soul and the human mind, which is from here we can create. From here we have we regain the power and regenerate the power of the eternal and the infinite back into our souls, so we can move on and move on and move on to create the experiences that we were sent back to, where we were incarnated or reincarnated to complete. And it's a remarkable thing. We got about 10 minutes left of the show, and I notice there's nobody in the chat room here, but I was trying to imagine any other feeling that radiated that kind of power and energy, and I can only think of few, and that's being on the water again, just being on the water in a boat. When I was a child, I was a teenager actually, but also about 11, 12, 13 years old, one of the greatest feelings of my life, one of the greatest highs, if you will, was taking out my we used to summer on a lake up in Maine, and it was called Long Lake actually, but it was about a mile long, and I used to take a boat out. It was an outboard motor, open fishing boat actually. It was a Starcraft, 25 horsepower Evinrude on the back of it, and I used to take it out for spin, especially on the most choppy days and in the roughest weather. I used to love it because I used to have white caps and there were, you know, swells on the lake. And what I would do is I would rev up my boat and ride out there and just charge the waves, charge them, just charge right into them and skip right over the top of those waves. And it was the most exhilarating feeling. But, you know, I'd do that, and I love to do that. My brothers did it. We all challenged each other, you know, who could hit the highest waves and cut through them. And, you know, you'd almost become airborne, and, you know, in the boat, once you hit those waves, and boom, 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 and the front of the boat would just crash into the bow of the boat would just crash right into the head of those waves and cut right through them. And it was the power that you had. It was kind of not just the outboard and the speed, but it was almost as though you were, can't quite explain it. It was almost as though you were regurgitating, if you will, or recycling, or flowing the power of that water. And at the same time, you felt that you were beating the water, you're beating nature, and man against nature, you know, speed and power, and you just kept going and going and going. And that was 25 horsepower open boat. Was really, you know, wasn't really fast, but, you know, you could get on with a pretty fast clip, and if you weren't careful, you could capsize. If you had a swell that was large enough, you know, on those windy days, it just, boom, you know, you just go right into a 5-foot swell or something, and that could knock you over. But it didn't. You know, you gauge yourself. You know, you gauge yourself. You find yourself in the zone when you're doing this, and you just, you know, you have enough experience driving those boats, which I did. I mean, many, many years of experience, even though I was a teenager. I've been riding boats since I was, 8 or 9 years old. 10 years old, and you know, for all those years, you just had that experience. But my parents, it was funny. They used to watch us go, you know, right in the middle of the night, and get the biggest kick out of that because they knew we could handle the boats. But they knew how much fun we were having. My father was a boatsman as well, but we that was, I never quite understood why the water always exhilarated me, but in that way. But until I read this article, and I've always felt the connection to water, strong connection to the ocean, strong connection to the vast bodies of water, and like when you get near them, you feel you become a part of them, and that's what that's the way I always felt. But so I was grateful to discover this essay, and I Wonders of Ocean, and it means quite a bit to me to understand now that the iconic concept of the ocean to our own consciousness, and how if we believe that we live in a three-dimensional illusion of our own making, then yes, that somehow we had to manifest into our reality our own consciousness. And that consciousness is represented as the ocean, this vast, vast, vast body of water, which is our origins, and which harbors endless numbers of species and varieties of life and inspiration and again, salvation, purification, everything to be found in the oceans, life, death, and fear, and joy, and God, if you will. But anyway, we're almost at the end of the show. We've got about 4 minutes left. I see nobody, there's no calls, but I hope that you will go, if you can, you can go to Google, or you can go to Yahoo or something, and enter Manly, M-A-N-L-Y, P. Hall, and you can put in his lectures, if you will, just put in lectures, or put in, you might want to try Wonders of Ocean, and see if that lecture will come up, and then I'd suggest you read it. But also, you might want to research anything to do with a man's consciousness and his concepts of the ocean. I think you'll find them revelatory, and I think you'll find them enlightening. So, in the last minute or so, I think we'll end a little early tonight, but I want to thank you all for joining us, and I hope that you enjoyed this this lecture, and I wish you good night. And please join us tomorrow night right here at 8 o'clock when we speak with George Dixon. And we'll be talking, I believe we may continue to talk about fractal consciousness quantum physics and how we are in more than one place at one time and how our bodies are basically illusions. How the third dimension is an illusion and we're virtually a spiritual being. Outside that body, creating this body, the third dimensional body, so that we might re-experience some form or some lesson that must be learned karmically or otherwise to progress this evolution of our spirit. So, thank you, and join us tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. We have George Dixon, and good night.